thinker, and this is Man in the Mirror by the late Michael Jackson.
I'm gonna make a change for once in my life. It's gonna feel real good. Gonna make a difference. Gonna make it right. As I turn up the collar on my favorite winter coat, this wind is blowing my mind. I see the kids in the street without enough to eat. Who am I to be blind, pretending not to see them need? A sonorous disregard, a broken bottle top, and one man's soul. They follow each other on the wind, you know, 'cause they got nowhere to go. That's why no one yet to know.
And you're listening to Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And why did we play that song?
Well, we're going to be talking about Michael Jackson a little bit. If anyone hasn't heard, the man died last week, Ethan.
Oh my God, really?
I believe it was cardiac arrest.
Are you sure he's not faking his death?
Yeah, well, that's why I think not only was it a big day because it was the death of an icon, but it was also a big day because it was the start of a brand new conspiracy theory that we'll all be able to enjoy for the next 50 years.
A conspiracy on a conspiracy. Michael Jackson had his own share of conspiracies beforehand and controversies.
Well, we'll get to that later in the show.
A little later. Speaking of other big events that happened, what happened this day in history?
Well, there's a couple big events. For example, in 1860, there was the Oxford Evolution Debate between Thomas Henry Huxley and Bishop Samuel Wilberforce, and quite a big event in the world of evolution. And
I'm not sure that Huxley was the debater. I think he was in the audience. There was a point at which Wilberforce said at some point, was it through his grandfather or his grandmother that he claimed his descent from a monkey? And at this point, I think there's someone who wrote in his diary that Huxley, at this point, slapped his hand into his fist and jumped up and said, ha, I've got him.
Well, that was very good for him.
And it was well acted.
Yes.
Yeah.
And actually, to be right, Rob's right, there was actually several people involved in this debate. It was more of a discussion group as opposed to a one-on-one. But the noteworthy ones after that were Huxley and Wilberforce.
Yes. What else happened this week in history? Something is itching at the back of my
mind. Something that happened around 1867, perhaps the birth of our nation.
Yes! Woo! Canada Day is tomorrow.
Happy birthday.
And history fact, Canada is older than Germany.
Ooh.
I'm just saying, because
That's interesting and weird.
Yeah. Although we're also older than Australia and Burundi and, really.
Yeah, well, a lot of countries, actually.
All right. Yeah. So, on to our first topic.
Yes, well,
so what's up with Michael Jackson?
Right, Michael Jackson's dead. And I thought, apparently, right after he died, all of a sudden, a huge conspiracy pops up. Is he really dead, or is this a fake? Apparently on Twitter, just minutes after the death of Michael Jackson.
I was following the hashtag Michael Jackson on Twitter, and like as soon as reports started coming in that he was dead, just minutes later, people were saying, I just saw Michael Jackson at the KFC, and it's just like Elvis all over again, really.
Yeah, with the exception, well, no, maybe not the exception. I was just reading the news the other day about how Michael Jackson's mother is arranging for another autopsy, a private autopsy, to find out exactly why he's dead, and taking custody of his children and, of course, his estate. So, is this like Elvis? Were any of us here when Elvis was dead? I mean,
when did Elvis die?
I was alive,
die?
But 75, wasn't it?
Yeah, I wasn't born then.
Why on the day that Michael Jackson is faking his own death would he show up at KFC when he has pretty much not been seen for months and months?
Well, it's a good point. I mean, there's a lot of interesting theories out there about Michael Jackson. Maybe you could sort of give us a run through on some of the more wacky
ones.
Right,
Michael Jackson's always been around, has been hanging around some weird conspiracy theories in his life. The one that I wanted to talk about today was this theory, actually, I wanted to talk about a while ago, but it wasn't very topical. So finally, you guys have given me the green light to talk about this on the show.
This is something that we were going to maybe talking about in the first or second episode. Elon has wanted to do
Elon, Elon has arranged for a media event so that he could present this
you
topic.
You killed him!
So there was a rumor that some people really still believe that Michael Jackson, who, if you all remember, was born a black man, died more so a white man from his visual appearance. A lot of people think that
possibly
this...
Possibly a skeleton man.
A lot of people thought that Michael Jackson purposely had some sort of magic... Well, magic. Some sort of surgery to convert himself from black to white in order to... I don't even get exactly why he would do that. I guess some people think that so he could be more accepted by the racist mainstream.
The original theory, from what I remember, was that he had fallen in love with Diana Ross, and he wanted to be more like Diana Ross, and Diana Ross was several shades lighter than he was naturally. And that's also the explanation for all his cosmetic surgery, which gives this theory, although it sounds nuts on the surface, Michael Jackson is renowned for fixing bits and parts of him all over. That's why he's got that funny nose, which was an operation gone bad.
So actually, the first time Michael Jackson had surgery wasn't because of reconstructive surgery. From what I know, apparently he was filming a Pepsi commercial, and then there was some fireworks that went wrong, and his hair and some of his face got set on fire. And he had to go to the hospital for that, which isn't funny at all, obviously. And
we're not laughing.
Well, good. Because it's serious. But he was okay.
Wait, just spoil the moment, Elon.
he had to have surgery, and then I guess there were some complications which led to him requiring some other surgeries. But let's get to the point of Michael Jackson. How did he go from black to white?
Yeah, how did he go from black to white? Was he out in the sun too long?
So Michael Jackson had a disease.
That would actually reverse the process, wouldn't it?
I'm ignoring that. So Michael Jackson had a disease called vitiligo, which is a chronic skin disease that causes loss of pigment, resulting in irregular pale patches of skin. So vitiligo is a real disease. There's a lot of people who have this. There's a website, the NVFI.org, National Vitiligo Federation I something. And so that's a foundation for people with the disease. And so, right, so Michael Jackson had this disease, and what causes is this pigmentation. And actually how it happens is people who have this disease tend to not just convert really quickly from black to white, but they will sort of, their skin will start having blotches, and over time they'll get paler and paler. So then some people might say, oh, why did Michael Jackson seem to have this like sudden shift? And the answer to this is simply he was in the entertainment business, and he would use cover up and makeup to cover up the blotches at first, you know, until it was too late, and then finally he just had to, like, you know,
I guess he didn't want to look like a Holstein cow.
So now you've exposed the conspiracy. How does such a thing come about? I mean, why was Michael Jackson a conspiracy, but John Smith, my neighbor who has the same condition, not a conspiracy?
Because he's a celebrity.
The funny thing about that, though, is why would Michael Jackson want to get more famous? He already had the most popular album ever in Thriller. Why would he go, I need to get more famous, I'm going to dye my skin white?
Right, well, that's also the thing of the people who claim that the reason he did it was that he could get more, be more accepted mainstream. Like, this is Michael Jackson. Like, he was the most famous person as a black man. He has no reason to think that, like, he'll, you know, people will accept him. If anything, people thought he was really weird after this happened because it's such an odd occurrence. But one quote from Michael Jackson in 1993, which hopefully will clear it up, he said this on Oprah's show, which we talked about Oprah last week, but this was a fair interview by Oprah, and he said, I'm a black American, I'm proud to be black American, and I'm proud of who I am. And he really wanted everyone to know that he didn't purposely, you know, change races.
Well, that's good to know, I suppose.
You know, there's actually, it's some, in some ways, Oh, I'm not. I don't want to say it's good because that's not the right thing. But I mean, Michael Jackson's life has been such a roller coaster ride. I mean, a lot of people compared him to people like Elvis or the Beatles. And as far as fame goes, that's quite true. Mm-hmm. But one of the big differences between those people is they became famous when they were young adults. Michael Jackson became famous when he was a little kid.
Five or six, right?
You know, and one of the things that keeps reoccurring throughout his life is he's saying, you know, he was robbed of his childhood that he had, you know, his parents abused him, whether that was true or not, but he still believed it, right? And a lot of the weirdness that you get from it is you'd only have a superstar, which gets weird in itself, but someone who's only ever known being a superstar, who grew up in that entire climate.
I guess to conclude this segment, Carl Sagan, who we're going to talk about later, made this quote that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And if you're going to make a claim that someone purposely converted from being black to white, first you have to ask yourself questions like, why would he do it? Also, how would he do it? No one else that I've ever heard of has made this surgery.
Except in Tropic Thunder.
Wait, I didn't see Tropic Thunder. I hear it's amazing.
Well, we'll be back with an interview after these commercial messages.
Beautiful country. You know, I rode out here about 50 years ago on a little dun horse and started a film career. Picture called The Big Trail. Well, I made quite a few since then. Some good, some bad. Matter of fact, in those days...
CITR!
Matter of fact, they come in pretty handy anytime. It's kind of nice to... Oh, you have something set aside. So if you ever figure on that, remember that
CITR
can be mighty helpful. Yeehaw!
And we're back. We're just about to play an interview that I did while I was in London with Alice Tuff of an organization called Sense About Science.
So, could you tell our listeners a little about Sense About Science and what you do?
Well, we're a charity that was basically set up to respond to the misrepresentation of science and to promote good science and evidence to the public. And what that means is that we basically work with scientists to explain where the science and evidence is on controversial issues. But also we look to sort of give people the tools to make sense of the sort of claims themselves as well.
So do you work with scientists and other organizations?
Yeah, well, we have a database of about 3,000 scientists, and that ranges from people at PhD level right up to postdocs, Nobel laureates as well. And we also work quite closely with professional societies. Anyone can also contact us for help, and that's mostly people who talk to the public. So it's things like patient groups, medical research charities, local education authorities. And when they're struggling with an issue or they want to speak to scientists, we'll put them in contact with someone to try and help them on it.
All right, so you're like a aid agency between journalists and scientists.
Kind of. So we work with sort of all sectors. So although we work with journalists as well, it's sort of everybody basically who talks to the public. And that's sort of the way we sort of push the information out is through the different groups, different intermediaries.
All right. And there's one part of your organization called Voice. Could you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, Voice is a network of PhD and postdocs, and that was basically set up because when we first started we found that there weren't many early career scientists getting involved in public debates. So we wanted to find out why. We spoke to them, and what we found was that most were really passionate about it but weren't quite sure how to get started, what other people would think of them, whether anyone would even want to listen to them. So we set up a series of media workshops which gives them a chance to hear from scientists who've had media experience, both good and bad. Hear from journalists about their life and the pressures they're under, and also a little bit of practical information at the end. But we've grown from since then because participants wanted to stay in touch, which is how the network was formed, and then now have their own forum, their own projects and messages, and they're very active in sort of investigating pseudoscientific claims and or looking for where the evidence is.
So what's one of their most recent projects?
Well, actually, yesterday they just launched something where they're basically calling on the World Health Organization to say something about the promotion of homeopathy in developing countries, because they're quite concerned because there's a conference in the Netherlands this week where lots of homeopaths are getting together to talk about the use of homeopathy for prevention of things like AIDS and TB, which obviously is quite shocking because there's no evidence for homeopathy. So they're quite outraged by this, and when they looked around on sort of the WHO site, they found there's actually no advice on this, and so they're calling on the WHO to actually sort of say something on this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Our listeners will know quite a lot about what bunk homeopathy is.
So it's quite shocking when you look around and just see kind of the amount of sort of clinics that are being set up in developing countries, particularly Africa, and they're sort of touting the remedies as an alternative and a cheap alternative as well, which makes it even more difficult for people in those countries who are already medics already over there trying to deal with these issues. You know, there's enough complications with political situations and things like that, so this is just an added layer that makes it more difficult for them to do the job they're doing. And actually, when the letter that they've sent to WHO, they've actually reached out to some other medics in Africa and got some of them to sign up on board.
Is VOICE an international organization? Can people from any country join?
Well, it's good thing you asked that, actually. We just actually, Centre for Science itself, we've just set up an international site ourselves. And one of the first things we're looking to do is to internationalise VOICE. So at the moment, we're talking to a few other people in other countries and hoping to run some of our workshops to look to pilot them as something for other people to take on, with a view to sort of building networks of VOICE in other countries, leading to a sort of international network of VOICE. But we also always welcome people from other countries to join, so the more the merrier.
Well, if you send one of your workshops to UBC, we'll send a lot of people your way.
Fantastic.
So what do you do at the office?
My title is Development Manager, so I sort of spend half my time coordinating the VOICE Young Science Network, and then the rest of my time sort of funding a strategy and looking to build relationships with other organisations, which then other people in the office take on. So it's kind of a mixture. I get to talk to lots of different people, which is the fun part.
Hence the interview.
Yep.
What are some other organizations that you're working with?
Well, we work a lot with the patient groups and medical research charities. We actually this year responded because a lot of the neurological charities were quite worried about cures being touted on the web to their patients, and they were dealing with a lot of phone calls about things like goat's blood serum, which was being promoted for multiple sclerosis patients. And they also felt that the patient forms were being abused and that people were pretending to be patients in order to sell some of these products.
Oh.
So they were really struggling to deal with that. So we worked with them to sort of draw out useful information and tools for people to know about and to sort of respond directly to the questions patients are asking. And that's very much the way we work, because we're always trying to respond directly to the questions people ask and trying to get the scientists to respond to that. At the same time, also drawing out useful insights for people. So with the patient guide, it was things like, why do unproven treatments seem to work, explaining the different phases of clinical trial, and also explaining peer review, which is something that people find is quite a helpful thing into debates about the quality of science. So that's an area of work that's quite big for us that we're doing a lot with at the moment, looking to sort of take that on with other patient groups and work with them to try and respond to these sorts of issues.
Yeah, I saw on your website a PDF of advice compiled by some former patients and people. I think it was What's the Harm? Or something like that.
Yeah, I've got nothing to lose by trying it.
Yeah.
It's just fine until you try and say it 5 times over quite quickly.
And so the organization publishes a lot of these sort of PDFs and disseminates them through the website about...
We also produce hard copies. What we do with when we do these, because we also do our Making Sense of series, and that tends to be when we're far fighting on an issue, we feel we're having to respond to a lot, we'll get together a working group of scientists, we'll look at what the kind of questions people are asking around this, we'll look at what the media coverage is, what things like campaign groups are saying, and then we'll get the scientists to respond directly to those. And those then are normally aimed at a particular sector. So, for example, one of the first ones we did was on chemicals. And that was responding to, it was a very sort of anti-chemical feel at the time. People were saying things like, you can lead a chemical-free lifestyle, natural is always better than artificial, things like that. And that was very aimed at the health and lifestyle journalists who would ring us up, and they weren't even sure whether sometimes things were a science story or not. And they would be like, can I actually talk to people about things like this? So it was trying to give them the information and then also let them know there were scientists there that they could talk to. We also did one on radiation, and that was mostly aimed at local education authorities who are having to deal with questions about Wi-Fi in schools, which in the UK was a big issue about a year ago.
Yeah, actually in France they're calling to ban cell phones being used in classes because of the dangers from the radiation.
Yeah, that was an interesting one, because actually it's contrary to all the evidence. I think they actually said that. They just said that there's a particular law where they can just choose to sort of ignore what the evidence is and just pass it anyway. My colleague was talking about it.
So what do you think of journalists, science journalists, that don't have much of a science background? Do you encourage them to not necessarily have a science background, to come talk to scientists straight from the source, or would you rather
I think it actually it's not a problem with journalists not having a science background. Some of the best ones in the UK don't. For example, Mark Henderson, who's science editor at the Times. And what they'll always say is that actually, because you're dealing with all different types of science, sometimes it doesn't actually benefit you. So if you're a physicist trying to write up a biology story, actually sometimes it's just as difficult. So not having a science background could be an asset. I think we're quite lucky in the UK, actually. Our science journalists are fairly good. They try within the constraints of what they're doing. And the main thing is giving them access to the scientists. And that's a really important thing, because if the scientists don't fill the gap, they'll have to find someone else too, and it may not be someone who is particularly able to explain the science and evidence. It might be someone who's got an agenda of their own, so that's why it's important that scientists speak out.
Do you have any advice for scientists, especially the young scientists that want to join Voice, over how to get involved and how to talk to the media?
I would always say start with a small thing sometimes. So there's lots of things you can do. It may seem really difficult when, I think, from my experience talking to early career researchers, it often feels like, well, what can I actually do? Does anyone actually want to hear from me? First of all, I say yes, people do want to hear from you. We always get so much attention when Voice do stuff, so much excitement from both senior scientists and journalists to see young sort of lively scientists. And the other thing is you can also start with the small things. So it's simple things like if you see something in a newspaper that you feel strongly about, write a letter. It's something that actually the letters page is one of the best read pages, and sometimes you'll get more space than the quote in an article. It's also really good to talk to your local press if you're interested in sort of doing media stuff, because that's a really great way to get started. Normally, if you can give your work a local flavour or related to something that's going on locally, they find it really interesting. They're always sort of looking for stories to run. So there's lots of sort of things to get started.
All right. Any other things you want to bring up?
Join Voice.
All right.
The more the merrier. It's a supportive network, and it's great because it's a good chance to sort of exchange ideas and support. And there's also, they've got their own publications on our website that anyone can access, particularly they've done some investigations looking into pseudoscientific product claims. They did one on detox products that came out in January this year. So, yeah, go and have a look.
All right. Thank you, Alice. And be sure to check out Sense About Science website.
And if you want to find Sense About Science website, it's at senseaboutscience.org.
Ever thought about volunteering with Big Sisters? Maybe now is the time. Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland provides girls aged 7 to 17 with a champion, a mentor who's there to simply be their friend and cheer them on. Become a study buddy tutor and spend 1 hour a week helping your little sister learn to love school. Or become a big sister and spend 3 fun hours a week just hanging out with your little sister. If you're age 19 or older, please visit bigsisters.bc.ca to find out more. Maybe now is the time.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. So we're going to be talking a bit now about a kit, a baloney detection kit, if you will, for our listeners to learn about.
Baloney.
Baloney. Did I say baloney?
Twice.
Okay, well, don't do that then. All right, so, this kit, what is it, Rob?
It's a phrase that Carl Sagan coined, the baloney detection kit, to detect baloney, to discriminate between science and pseudoscience. And I actually just saw a video recently that Michael Shermer put up through the Richard Dawkins Foundation. You can find it on YouTube if you Google Michael Shermer Baloney Detection Kit. And it's 10 questions to ask when considering any claim. And the number one question on the list is, how reliable is the source of the claim? So it's a question of how do you decide whether something is reliable? And when you find out how reliable it is, you can go on to the other questions.
Right. And I actually happen to have Carl Sagan's book here with me, The Demon Haunted World. I recommend our listeners read it because it's awesome. And he lists a few points to keep in mind about, you know, detecting BS and all that sort of stuff. He mentions whenever possible, there must be independent confirmation of the facts in quotation marks. One thing that he mentions I think is really important is he says, try not to get overly attached to a hypothesis just because it's yours. It's only a way station in the pursuit of knowledge. Ask yourself why you like the idea. Compare it fairly with the alternatives. See if you can find reasons for rejecting it, because if you don't, others will.
maybe as a good example of examining the source. Let's say if you're reading an article in the Vancouver Sun or something, and it's talking about how great it's like an opinion piece, and it's talking about how great homeopathy is or how great some sort of alternative medicine is. And then you go and find out that the author of this article has also written a whole bunch of other articles, like all about pseudoscience. All of a sudden, then you think, oh, maybe this source isn't so reliable, since every single article he writes is about the same.
We should actually, we'll do this maybe as a mashup, because I got some information I got from the Marketplace website about how to determine a good source and information.
Oh, good Canadian and website.
Excellent Canadian content too. So on the same topic, they say that, you know, the information should be easily identified. I mean, that's one of the things that you're mentioning. You know, someone says something. Do you know who they are? Do you know where the information is coming from? Is it accurate, unbiased information? And is it being presented by someone who may have an ulterior motive? I mean, are they funded by, you know, one of the pharma companies, or do they have someone who died and they've got a grudge against the company, or are they just some whack job or something? Because, you know, but the point is that when you look at a source of information, it should be easily identifiable where their information comes from. And as Ethan has mentioned, you know, that information should be scientifically rigorous, right?
Exactly.
It's sort of like applying the scientific method to how you gather knowledge about really anything, and just sort of thinking critically. If someone presents an idea, look at it from their point of view, but also look at it and say, what does this person have to gain by convincing me about this?
Yes, the number 10 question on Michael Shermer's list of baloney detection kit questions is, do the claimant's personal beliefs and biases drive the conclusion, or vice versa?
Just to go back, sorry, but one of the things, too, is when you look at sources, you should follow up on the sources. I've been to a few websites that have footnotes, and they say, this source is from here, and you go click and you go check what the web source is, and it's like the New York Times. No article, nothing, just, I got this from the New York Times. You can hunt it down where in the New York Times it comes from. So, I mean, not only does it have to be a specific source, but specific as in, where did they make this claim supposedly...
Have the claims been verified by another source?
Exactly. And that's not to say that the evidence doesn't speak for itself. Like, no matter who makes the claim, because that's a logical fallacy, this ad hominem argument where the claim isn't true just because the person is maybe has some of these negative qualities. Obviously, like, you have to examine the evidence, but this is just sort of a guide of, like, if you're presented with a claim and the person, the source that you're hearing the claim from isn't someone that seems like that will be unbiased, it means you have to be extra careful when you're looking at the evidence to make sure.
Excellent point.
But then when you do come to a claim that seems like the source is pretty reliable, you can still ask some questions about the claim. From the baloney detection kit again, number 4, how does the claim fit with what we know about how the world works?
Yep, that would go with the number 3. Says, is this information supported by scientific evidence? You know, large scale studies, that kind of thing. And you're right. Does it fit? Is it if I sit there and I make the claim,
like cold fusion or something?
Exactly.
How much about what you already know do you have to throw out or change in order to accommodate the new claim?
Right.
Well, it's the old sort of standby that the best science explains the most with the least amount of leaps
additional assumptions.
Yeah.
I guess you could say.
And Carl Sagan even mentions that if there's a chain of logic in the argument, every chain has to be correct. You can't have a faulty premise that leads to a correct conclusion. Every inch of that argument has to make logical sense.
I think this happens a lot in the intelligent design community when they're talking about their big argument is, you know, oh, evolution isn't true for the following reasons, but what they're not answering is then how do you explain all this other evidence that supports evolution? This is stuff we know about the world. Not only does your theory have to, you know, prove that, you know, evolution is false, you also have to prove then how is all this other evidence, how did it get there?
Not to mention sometimes the claim doesn't actually provide any explanation or evidence. I mean, question, is the claimant providing an explanation for the observed phenomena or merely denying the existing explanation?
That's a big one to a lot of the anti-vax movement, intelligent design. They're not arguments for their particular field, they're just arguments against the whatever thing they're arguing against.
And that points out, too, I mean, one of the big things about science is science comes up with a theory. That theory isn't perfect. It's going to change over time. But at the moment, this is the best explanation for whatever we have. And can it be improved? Yes, with time it will be improved. But it is the best explanation so far to account for all the data that we have.
And how the information was arrived at. Just one more question before we go. Is the claimant employing the accepted rules of reason and tools of research, or have these been abandoned in favor of others that lead to the desired conclusion?
So really good tips to make sure you don't get swindled out
and
there.
You can find that video online again if you Google Michael Shermer baloney detection.
We'll post it on our blog, which is at
ubcfreethinkers.blogspot.com.
And if you have any comments for us, please email us at
radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
Speaking of emailing us at radio.freethinker.com, we're going to have a contest, actually.
Dun, da, da, da.
We're very excited about this.
Our very first contest.
We've been provided with two tickets to the Xavier Rudd concert tomorrow night, and we've decided we want our listeners to email us with pictures of yourself listening to Radio Freethinker. Show us what you look like, in what pose, perhaps, and in what location are you listening to our contest.
We should point out we want PG-13 pictures here, folks.
These will be posted on the blog.
Why did you say PG-13 and not PG?
Well, I don't know.
They're allowed to be a little edgy.
Yeah, if they want
to,
you know.
They're allowed to say things like crap.
Yeah, if they want to have like a thought bubble above their head or something.
So blood is allowed, but no gore. So
essentially, yeah. Limited drug use.
Send us your images to radio.freethinker@gmail.com, and the one that we like the best will send you an email to tell you how to get your tickets to see Xavier Rudd tomorrow.
That's fantastic. So, we have a skeptical quote to go out on.
Yes. This is a quote for all of you people who are really sad about Michael Jackson having died. This might be a nice quote by Richard Dawkins, sort of putting the whole idea of death into perspective. We are going to die, and that makes us the lucky ones. Most people are never going to die because they are never going to be born. The potential people who could have been here in my place, but who will in fact never see the light of day, outnumber the sand grains in Arabia. Certainly those unborn ghosts include greater poets than Keats, scientists greater than Newton. We know this because the set of possible people allowed by our DNA so massively exceeds the set of actual people. In the teeth of these stupefying odds, it is you and I, in our ordinariness, that are here. Richard Dawkins from Unweaving the Rainbow.
Excellent. Well, so time to say goodbye. So this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying goodnight.
This is Don, the philosopher of political science, saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Elon, the computer science nerd, saying have a good evening.
And this is Rob, the cognitive psychologist, saying have a great Canada Day.
Woo!
Bye-bye, everybody.
Woo, party!
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty. And I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
Join Team PowerSmart. Set an energy conservation target of 10%. You'll get access to tools to help you conserve, and you can track your progress online. Visit bchydro.com/Team PowerSmart to join today. This message brought to you by BC Hydro PowerSmart and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Out there will be smashed to bits. Use your emergency equipment.
It won't work. Nothing works. It's got to. It's no use. Everything seems to be stuck.
My light's worth a try anyway. Come on, fellas. You can make it.
Just listen to this. Spider-Man saves freighter.